first of all, Ellie, for what's already promising to be an extremely well-coordinated trip. And I think he brought Western efficiency to places didn't know what efficiency was. So big Yasha Kayach for everything till now and how much work you put in. I'd like to thank my son Yaakov for the work he put into it. And for there were many other people behind it. I think David was very involved in being supportive. And first of all, on a personal note, the trip really started as a very personal thing for me. I grew up, my father was from Kovna. He grew up in Kovna, Linz Labotke. He got married, had children, lived in Kovna. And it was very much part of the culture I grew up in. I always wanted to come see it. Somebody had promised me to take me on a trip. This was a person who lived there himself, much younger than my father. About a year ago, I realized it'll never happen. And Yaakov very much urged to put together a trip like this. So Yasher Koyach to everybody for coming and to make the trip possible. Yasher Koyach. I'd like to speak a little bit of a broader introduction on the meaning of what we're seeing and so on and so forth. I first want to start by saying that Klal Yisrael has now, I could say, three broad focal points for Yiddishkeit. There was Kehillah focus, which was typical of Oberland, Germany, Sephardic communities, for the most part. There was one type of focal point. There was the emergence of Chassidus, which focal point was Rebbes, Chatzeris, and sort of transcended local Kehillas, and was focused around the Rebbe movement and so on. That was typical of Poland, Galicia, and parts of Hungary, lower parts of Hungary especially. And then you have a third focal point, which was the yeshivas, and that is typical of parts of Russia, Lithuania, and vague areas of what's called Belarus and so on. The three different focal points, each one has their milos and chesronos. Each one comes with its strengths and weaknesses, and for us, no matter what our personal heritage was, most everybody here has somehow or other come through the yeshiva world. That has become a dominant feature of today's world, even though there is shifting and so on. We'll speak more when we get to each yeshiva about the special yichud of each yeshiva, but briefly, I would like to point out four tkufas in the development of modern yeshivas. You have Volozhin, which started the world of yeshivas in the following way. Until Volozhin was there, yeshivas were basically very personal. The Marashah was a Rav of a town. He was a big Talmid Chacham. Talmidim came to him, the town, as part of taking him as a Rav, agreed to support X amount of Talmidim, and he had a yeshiva. They came to learn about a Marashah. Marashah died, there was no more yeshiva. The yeshiva was the Marashah, it was like, and so on. You didn't have a yeshiva as an institution. It tended to be very local. In the communities that had it, it was sort of a educational system for people in the community. It didn't transcend its person, its specific area, and that was what a yeshiva was. Volozhin changed that, and we'll speak more when we get there tomorrow, Bitz Hashem. Volozhin was an institution. It transcended Reb Chaim Volozhin. It was meant to last. It was meant for Talmidim far and wide. It was meant to be totally independent of the community it was serving. It was meant to sort of become a dominant force in its own right, and not just a way to produce Rabbanim and so on and so forth. That was a first stage in yeshiva, in what's today what we call yeshiva. towards the end of the 19th century, you began to have other yeshivas being founded, and you begin to have a struggle of the Musa system to become part of it. And we might speak more about it in Slobodka, but by and large, it was Rabbi Sol Salanter was active in that period of time. His Talmidim, most notably the Alta Slobodka, began to be mashpia on yeshivas, to have Musa in the yeshivas. And Kletzk was a very important part of that. We'll speak about it later when we get to it. But I guess the Musa movement, in terms of its influence on yeshivas, it hadn't started as such. Musa, Rabbi Sol Salanter, vision as part and parcel of Klal Yisrael. Balabatim would have special places to go learn Musa and so on and so forth. It was probably Aldous Labotka who recognized that you need to have it become integrated in the yeshiva system. It met resistance for the following reasons. First of all, any new limud to bring into the yeshiva system, people were very suspect about it. They felt it would detract from the learning. It would create a whole nother epicenter of activity. They were wary of that. The mashgiach became a very, very important figure in the yeshivas. He also began to have an opinion by which Talmidim were not ready to be in yeshiva. Talmidim whose dais he felt were off, he was not very happy with, and they would throw them out. That brought about tremendous resentment. It was a feeling that there would be a new foci of power in the yeshiva, and it would be somebody who was not the dominating Torah figure per se, but it was something else. They also began creating a system where Bachner are closer to him and so on, different yeshivas. So you had all of this resistance, and that was typical of the end of the 1800s, beginning of 1900s. World War I broke out in 1914, and it devastated European Jewry. A lot of the Chor Beruchni was due to that. It basically destroyed all the kehillas. What happened was, the front was in most of this part of Europe, and it went back and forth between Germans, Russians, Austrians, and who knows who. And people did not want to stick around to watch the action. They'd rather not be in the line of fire. They moved inwards. There was a second reason. The Tsar, in his profound wisdom, reasoned that the Jews might want to go to the Germans. First of all, because Germans were more civilized than the Russians. Secondly, they were a bit kinder than the Tsar. And he felt that the Jews, speaking Yiddish, had a kinship with them. So the Tsar exiled many communities, a litter, into deep Russia. So for 5-6 years, the yeshivas were disbanded, destroyed. I mean, there were fragments and segments and all sorts of bits and pieces, different places. But for 5-6 years, it was not a natural matzav. And when they came back, there were a lot of issues. There were issues of getting it together again. It's much easier to break up a place than to start it again. There were issues of personnel. Some people had stayed and ran the yeshiva, and then they were not. So when the other group came back, Reb Roish, who has first rights, and so on and so forth, it created problems. But the yeshivas regrouped, and from 1920 to 1940 approximately, was the era of yeshivas, when everybody, whatever stories are heard from parents and grandparents about the yeshiva world, that's the period of time we're talking about. It came to maturity. The great names, the great yeshivas, everything you're familiar with, usually between 20 to 40, that's the dominant period. The Rosh Yeshivas I had, the Rebbeim I had, were from that period of time. The names you've heard, the yeshivas, were from that period of time. And those are basically the four broad periods of time of the what we call the yeshiva world. I want to speak a little bit about the geography. I only spoke about yesterday. You'll correct me if I'm wrong. The first thing is, as Americans, we grow up believing boundaries as being a very fixed entity. And there were colonies in America. Colonies had clearly defined boundaries. They became a country, and American boundaries were all there. The boundaries we recognize were always there, and that's that. Europe had a very, very different feel to it. Boundaries in Europe were meaningless, and for many reasons, and I just briefly trace some history. First of all, it was very difficult to run a large country when you don't have communications, transportation, or anything of that nature to make it feasible. So to run a country that was large was impossible. Rome was an empire for that reason, that they knew how to do it, but it took extraordinary brains of a certain type to do it. So Europe basically, especially this part of Europe, was a sort of, it started with little fiefdoms, duchies, it started with, then you started having grand duchies, and a lot of them were, the center of power was the local, the local power. They banded together, got a king. Various times, in various places, the king had different amounts of power. So countries were kind of very fluid, but the regions retained a lot of their character, and so on and so forth. As you mentioned yesterday, a dominant country, possibly the biggest between, let's say, 1400 to the end of the 1700s, was Poland, Lithuania. They were a commonwealth of two countries, the Grand Duchy of Lithuania and Poland. What's called Belarus today was very much part of Litva, and that's who they were. It was part of culturally, and everything else was part of that. At the end of the 1700s, Poland and Lithuania became second class minor league players, and major league players began to take bites out of it. The major league players were Russia, Prussia / Germany, and Austria-Hungary, and they began to nibble away, and in short order, by 1795, they had disbanded the entire thing, and they had swallowed up, Russia had swallowed up Lithuania, much of Poland, Germany had taken a bite, Austria had taken a bite, and they were gone. The Polish tried to revolt a few amount of times back and forth, on and off, but basically, so this was its own cultural entity of what we would call Litva, and certainly culturally Lithuania and here were the same type of people, same type of mentality, same type of mahaloch, but they were under the Tsar, and that's why all the stories in those days speak about the Tsar, because that was what it was about. The Tsar was not happy in swallowing so many Jews at that time. It really gave him a big stomach ache, and he began to think of what he could do to control them, make their lives a little bit. He tried to urge Aliyah to America. Basically, he created what was called a Pale of Settlements, that any of the Jews that he had swallowed can't move out into Russia proper, except with certain exceptions. And that's why when people speak of Russia, all the Jews living in Russia, we're talking about Belarus, Ukraine, rather than what's Russia proper. There were very, very few Jews in Petersburg and Moscow and so on. It was mostly here. This was all in the Pale of Settlements, more or less. And so what we called Russian Jewry really was here and further up north and so on, but within a certain frame. The vast interior of Russia was pretty much, it did not have many Jews there. During World War I, there was the Russian Revolution. Russian Revolution caused, they did not allow yeshivas. They clamped down very heavily on a lot of on everything Yiddish caused so many Jews ran away. Those who stayed basically couldn't raise the next door. What also happened was there was a short time when Belarus and Lithuania, when they had independence, they then had revolutions, they then joined up the Soviet Socialist Republic, and then Poland decided to take a little nibble out of here. And they fought the Russians, they actually won, and they ended up with a big chunk of here. So all the so-called Litvish yeshivas between 1920 to 1940 were technically in Poland, including Vilna and Mir and Kletsk, Baranowicz. All of those came out were technically Poland. You couldn't be in Russia and have a yeshiva, that was gone, because they did not allow it. And Lithuania had lost a big chunk of itself to the Poles. The Poles were much better fighters and took a big bite out of Lithuania. You also couldn't travel from Lithuania to Poland. They had no relations, no diplomatic relations. You had to go through another country entirely. You couldn't go with this passport. So that you had, for those 20 years, there actually was a certain bifurcation of the proper Lithuanian yeshivas, which are only four of them, Slabodka, Kelm, which was tiny, we'll maybe talk about it at some point, Panevich, and Telz. They were what's called Lithuania proper, what was Lithuania all along, but that was it. They were cut off from where most of the people were, which was this area, which was Belarus. So if you'll take a look at the documents from 20 to 40, all the Litvish yeshivas have Poland on it because that's where they came from. But it was culturally very, very different. Culturally, the Lithuanian Jews were, I guess, it's hard to be a stereotype, but you have, they were much more calm than Polish or Hungarian Jews or Ukrainian. They tended to be more, cerebral. They things of learning was important for that reason. They looked down at the emotional sentimentality of the Chassidim. They were very different. They were a lot more reserved and so on. Chassidus did make some impact on Russia, which again, Belarus means Russia, basically for Chassidus. Like he said, it's called Rasayn, and Rasayn and Rusya Levana. The three Chassidus that managed to penetrate, for better or for worse, was Chabad, which took on a very, very... It took on, the mentality was much more Litvish. Learning was the most important element, restraining your emotions, focusing it with your mind. It was very clear that Karlin was a Hasidus that was a Belarus Hasidus. There was also Slonim, which was Baranowicz, actually was for those years, for 2040, that was the center of Slonim and Hasidus, the Cheshuvim or Baranowicz. But certainly Slonim and Chabad had a very, very strong Litvish character, and they were different, you're very clearly, recognizably different. Another just interesting point, that it's not clear why it's called White Russia, Belarus, but if you look at the trees over here, and the bark is white, I forgot the name of the tree, you would know probably the name of the tree, that's one guess. If you'll see these are ubiquitous, these trees, that's one reason why you might call White Russia. But Akoponim, as far as we're concerned, Belarus and Litta proper are what we call Litta, culturally, it's the cradle of the yeshivas, and each yeshiva had its own special characteristics that we'll speak about when we get to each yeshiva, Bez Hashem. But that's why it's very important today, and today because there's a sort of an intermingling of different cultures, everyone's borrowed from the other, it has made the Litvish learning and style has made inroads in Siddhis world. Siddhis has made big inroads in the Litvish world. Kehillah is an emerging topic. But one more point of note, and again, Ellie touched on it briefly yesterday. If you'll notice, the yeshivas were all in hick towns. The reason was, there were a few reasons. One reason was, big cities had a way of having much distraction. There's very little to distract you in a hick town, and therefore everything's focused on yeshiva. You come to a big city, there's a lot going on, and therefore it was felt that it's a very poor place to make yeshiva. Two, the Jewry in the big cities had become less and less observant as time went on. The inroads of the Haskalah, of the Bund, they tended to focus on big cities. You had cultural centers, you had universities, theaters, operas, libraries. You were able to get critical mass of groups together, and therefore there was a lot of hashpahs coming in the big cities. So that was something negative. Also, in the big cities, you had a lot of politics in different kehillas, rabbanim, and getting into a big city would mean you would have political issues and you would be walking possibly a minefield. Fourth, small towns were able to support yeshivas in many ways. In the early days, when people ate by the townspeople, they felt a sort of a kinship. They looked out for the bucket, they rented rooms. We'll see as we talk about it later, but it was feasible in a small town. People tried to make yeshivas in the big cities. They were short-lived. Minsk had on and off, Lalach. Kovna did not have, they had a kolo. Slabodka is a suburb, and it's clearly away from it. What? Yeah, but it was on and off. It's Vilna wasn't able to pull it off. All the big cities never had a yeshiva for all the reasons we spoke about before. Lakewood supposedly was one of the reasons why I went there. It's not clear. I mean, he happened to get a building there. There was there waiting. Whatever his dreams were of having in a small town, there are chilukideas if that's still true today or not. We can ask the Lakewooders here what they think about it. But the yeshivas krochen was kosher. And that's why they kept yeshivas away from big cities. Slonim did not have one, Baranovich did have one, and so on. If you'll take a look at the history, that's where it went. I'll go upon it. So that's sort of an overview of where we came from. In other words, almost everything that we have today, we know that came from there. And Beres Hashem, we'll speak on each yeshiva, we'll try to speak more specifically about the people there. Okay.